This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Melissa Idris, and guest hosting with us this morning, Giri Balakrishnan.
Good morning, Sharad.
Good
Happy
morning.
Friday.
Yes, it is, in fact, a Friday. It's Friday the 3rd of August, that is. And we're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning with a range of interviews, news, and analysis. And remember, you can always be part of this conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio or WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Remember, because it's a new Malaysia, don't be scared to put your name there, like your real name. No need for IC number. We will do a little shout out if you do that. Also, the numbers to be had this morning. Apple there with 1 trillion. Malaysian males now 1 million more than women, and thousands of Bangladeshi teenagers paralyzing the streets of Dhaka.
Wow, Malaysian males now outnumber females by 1 million.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
I can't even believe myself. Hang on. So there are more men than women in Malaysia right now. Is that right?
Yes, by a factor of 1 million.
So, but it's not reflective in the dating pool, I'd have to say.
Because you've not had trouble finding a date. Yeah, well, I can say for my women friends that many of them, it's not so much a question of quantity, it's a question of quality.
Ouch.
No offense to anyone in the room. But yeah, this is interesting. Okay, so we'll come back to the population figures which were released by the Department of Statistics. I guess, you know, there are repercussions for this, right? So does this change the dynamics of society? What happens when there are more men than women? Surely there must be some slight shifts when it comes to the power dynamics or the gender dynamics in a society.
Yeah, there's that. And there's also the question of how do we get here? I mean, how do we get to a sex ratio of 100 females for 107 males? Now,
do we choose?
Well, in countries where you have normal population growth and you don't have, say, practices like female infanticide and sex preferences. So, people are doing checks on their fetuses, unborn fetuses, and checking to see the sex and having a male preference, a preference of male children. Why would you have such a skewed sex ratio? I mean, it's quite interesting.
Actually, it's an interesting point, but we also got to consider, for example, China and India, where there seem to be this imbalance where families prefer to have males than females. I think it's an economic question that needs to be answered to some degree. I know it sounds a bit crude, but that's what it...
No, it's also a cultural one, right? Yeah. There's a preference for male children, especially in a country like India where... I mean, I know it's very uneven, but you have things like the dowry system, right? So where female children represent the outflow of capital, whereas male children, would be... represent the inflow, right? Because
inflow of money.
Right?
Yep.
So the bride's family pays the dowry to the groom's side, right?
The sort of breadwinner idea, the males are... it's a bit...
Breadwinner is one thing. It's actually a cultural preference for men,
right?
And it's
a
patriarchal and and bigoted view of the world.
So what happens now when in Malaysia we have the sex ratio at 107 males to every 100 females, right? So what happens to that kind of 7 males?
And I think, you have to add to this number the fact that we have a huge non-citizen population, mainly consisting of single males, right? From Bangladesh, from Nepal. The Indonesians, I think, are much more balanced, but then I could be wrong in that.
So apparently, according to the Department of Statistics, the three major components for the population change are deaths, births, and net migration. So I guess, net migration, I think, is quite an interesting thing to look at. Are more women leaving the country as opposed to men?
Oh, it could be. Or migration, there could be also incoming.
Incoming, yes,
it could be.
Right.
Well, tell us what you think about the skewed sex ratios. You can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We'll be back. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Stevie Nicks with Talk To Me. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Melissa Idris, and a guest hosting with us this morning, Giri Balakrishnan. Remember, you can talk to us by tweeting us at BFM Radio or WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Thanks, Nick Hasuddin, for your tweet. Nick, you says, take out the foreign workers and the numbers will be balanced against. This is because of reference to the Statistics Department's population numbers. They say the ratio skewed.
For every 100 women, there's 107 men in Malaysia right now. So males outnumber females in Malaysia. He's making the argument that, okay, foreign workers are skewing the numbers, which is a valid point.
Well, exactly what I was saying earlier, except I didn't think that non-nationals would be included in the population census. It wasn't clear from the report.
From the report, yeah, you're right.
Which it, you know, which it is.
And what then again, we've got to also ask, what is the ratio of the male-to-female ratio of foreign workers who are coming into work as well? Because that would skew the numbers necessarily.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it'd probably be true of some sectors and from some ascending countries. Also, Tenny, thank you so much. You say you miss Melissa's voice, and she probably misses, you know, when she's stepped out of the studio, not on air too.
That's right. Well, if I'm not on air, I'm outside. I'm still listening intently, but thank you, Tenny, for your message this morning.
Well, speaking of listening, you know, job interviews are the ultimate in terms of having put yourself out in a situation where, you know, somebody's listening to you very intensely to find out whether you're right for the job. Apparently, there's some innovations in job interviews, and one of them is doing job interviews via text.
Yeah, so, you know, gone are the days of the face-to-face job interviews. I guess that's perhaps only one component of a job interview. Now there's job interviews via Skype and video. Apparently, according to a survey in Europe, there more young people prefer to text rather than talk. And it appears that this has bled into the human resource industry, where more and more job interviews are being conducted via text messaging. So your HR manager will get in touch with you and begin the process of interviewing for a job via text. How do you guys feel about that?
No, it's interesting because when we are talking about texting, there's one key component which I find seems to be missing, which is the expression of emotion. I know we have emoticons
got emoji
and
but in emojis face. And
yeah, but you know, it doesn't, that human touch, the human element seems to be missing. So how do you then identify who or what it is that you're talking to or talking with?
Sure, because things can get lost in translation and text. There's no conveyance of tone. There's no, I guess, you know, it's too succinct for you to kind of elaborate, isn't it?
But what about the fact that even in the face to face, people are their best behavior during a job interview, and can you trust the tone or what you see delivered in the face-to-face interview, right? So we always assume that it's more real, it's more authentic, that we're getting a window onto the person's, well, never mind their souls, but their minds. Is that really even true?
But the best HR managers are able to see past that. The best HR managers are able to read between the lines and able to, I guess, pick up on some of these nonverbal cues that happen during a face-to-face interview see through the fake, right? To see through the performance.
I think that's a good point, Melissa. I think we're talking about being able to read body language. Mm. Not everybody is adept at it, but then again, not everybody is adept at being a good actor. So you can't really, you know, fake to that extent where people can't really see what see right through you.
But I think what's also interesting about verbal interviews, so be it face-to-face or Skype or video or whatever, is the communication, right? Because that's a huge part of your job, being able to communicate with each other. How do you find out if someone is a good communicator via text, especially if everything's going to be in short form, like, you know, BTW or
okay,
whatever
you know,
it is.
What about it being a useful tool at an early stage, right? So the first round of interviews might be done by text, and if you secure that, then you might graduate to something further. Because even the Skype interview will deal with the possibilities of, say, if you work for a company that's global in nature and they want to interview candidates from around the world, not just in their own city.
Yeah.
Skype will be very useful, at least as a first round. And when you get to round three, maybe they'll fly you in for that face-to-face.
On business class, who knows? But you're absolutely right, because I think it's just part of the entire process. It's perhaps one round of it. What I think helps with this kind of new evolution of the hiring process is that, you know, you're not wasting time, right? So rather than come all the way for a sit-down face-to-face interview and waste time and resources, this is actually kind of eliminating or reducing the people who you don't think are best suited for the job, or if you yourself don't want the job?
Well, coming from an old school thought, wouldn't that be covered in the cover letter when you do the application for the job?
But cover letter can steal the template now, I hear.
Absolutely. There's all kinds of gaming of systems
right.
that happen on both sides of the of this divide. Now, tell us what you think. Would you encourage the use of text-based job interviews? Tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Lulu with To Sir With Love. I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Melissa Idris, and guest hosting with us this morning, Giri Balakrishnan. Now, of course, many of us remember our school days, and To Sir With Love is a well-known movie from the 60s that was all about school.
Okay.
Right? It was also a very anti-racist statement.
So she's professing her love to the teacher?
Yes.
I haven't watched it. I have to
You know, there are all kinds of love, right? The love that you feel towards a lover.
Admiration.
To love you have for God, you love you have for your parents, and the love you have for your teacher. But sometimes the teachers do a little nasty on you, and they take your report card and they write some sort of comment about you as a person,
wow.
right? Don't you remember those?
Yes.
I actually have my all report cards.
I do too.
No, I threw all of mine away.
Oh, okay. This is probably a sign of trauma. Giri, were you traumatized?
Badly. Mondays were the worst day for me. That was the day that we used to kena rotan lah, every Monday.
Okay, so you were clearly one of those naughty kids. Now,
what did you kena rotan for? This is quite scary. Should I know any behavioral disciplinary issues?
No, not that serious. Not that serious, I'm sure.
Okay, so the question is now, do these remarks that teachers make and often reflected in report cards, do they traumatize you? Do they, you know, are they taken seriously throughout your life? How do they shape your life?
Right. Okay. So I think I've told this story before, but I'm just going to repeat it because it's one of my favorite anecdotes. When I was moving, I was packing up my old house in Penang. I found my old report card from Standard 6. And then when you're 12 years old, you have to write your ambition, what you want to be, top three things you want to be when you grow up. And when I found it, I realized I had only filled in one segment. And the top one was to read the news, to become a newsreader. And I feel like that was so validating for me to find that report card. Granted, I no longer read the news on BFM, but I feel like I've done that. So that felt really good for me.
You know, mine has always been, and to some degree still is, to be a pilot. And I think that has never left my mind. I always had this imagination that being a pilot would be the best job in the world.
It does seem like it's the best job in the world, isn't it? Because it looks so glamorous and you fly around the world. But coming back to this, the teacher comment story, right? So this was triggered by the Financial Times, who spoke to some of their writers and, you know, different leaders and founders to see if there were lasting effects of teachers' comments in school. And I went to kind of think about that. There was one comment by a teacher that lingered with me for years. I was in Form 5, or no, I was in Form 6, and she said to me, "You look smart." And then I didn't know what she meant by that. Do I look smart, but I'm not really smart? Do I look smarter than I sound? Do I look smarter than I am? Didn't know what that meant. And it just stayed with me for the longest
right.
time.
Right. So the question is whether when you're young and you are perhaps just in that early stage of forming your personality, that comments from teachers, authority figures, can have a very dramatic effect on how you behave. Right.
Sure.
So for instance, when I was in preschool, and I still remember this, I couldn't write on the line. You know how you have to do your writing on the line in an exercise book. And the teacher said to me, "Look, this is a sign of creativity." She didn't say to me, "Oh, you know, bad boy, you know, take the ruler and smack me on my knuckles."
No rotan.
No rotan. But I do remember I had piano teachers in Klang, where I grew up I spent a year at, who used to regularly hit me on the knuckles with a ruler because, you know, I did not obviously practice enough piano before I went to my class, and traumatized me. And I think for many years, I just hated the idea of playing piano.
And rulers.
And no, rulers are important.
That's for playing the piano or not playing the piano properly. What happened if you weren't very good at maths? Where would they smack you then?
Well, the teacher I had from Standard 6 or Form 1, now she was extraordinarily, strict. And I think flinging the chalk was in the days of chalkboards.
Yes.
Flinging the chalk at you was... In fact, I remember every instance of violence I ever suffered at school. You know, I had a teacher, a history teacher, Form 1, who slapped me because I was talking to my friend,
But
the point is, we get over it, right? Most of us do.
But I have to say, though, it's an extraordinarily tough challenge, right? Because, you're dealing with these impressionable young minds at the most vulnerable age, and you have a classroom of 30, 40 students to manage. Sometimes you say things off the cuff. You think about how hard parenting is and you're worried that anything you say may scar your child for life. Think about having to deal with, a classroom of 40 students.
Well, regardless of the size of the class, we're talking about children at the formative age. Words of encouragement tend to go a long way. My own kids, when they come back and tell me, my teacher said, I did this well or I did that well. And, it puts a smile, a really big, genuine smile on their face. And it makes you feel good, too, because you know that somebody has acknowledged that the child has done something good. And I think that is really helpful in terms of encouraging the children to perform better.
Right,
rather
but
than
what if they'd stop performing well? What if they're lazy? What if they're naughty? What if they're, they just won't behave well and they're disruptive?
Uh-huh.
What should teachers do? Should they pretend? Are there words of encouragement in those scenarios?
Can I just say that as someone who had gone through a period like that in school, a teacher's kind word can really take you a long way. Just being noticed, being said, hey, Melissa, you've been quiet for this past few months. Is everything okay at home? Made such a difference for me.
Okay, tell us what you feel about this. If you've had any traumatic experiences, you remember your report card, tweet us at BFM Radio. WhatsApp is 018-789-8899. In fact, take a photograph of it and tweet it out to us. Taking us to the first bulletin of the morning of Monsters and Men with King and Lionheart. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Cure and Boys Don't Cry. In fact, some boys and girls in Bangladesh, in Dhaka in particular, are crying foul. I'm going to come to that story just as I introduce my co-host, Melissa Idris. And of course, guest hosting with us, Giri Balakrishnan, this morning. We talked about report cards earlier, and many of you sent in your tweets. I'm going to read some of your tweets and WhatsApp messages. Fern Raja Harris remembers being slapped on her legs as a young girl when she was just six, waiting to get into class.
Aww.
And she was told, just like a boy, she was admonished. This was a bad thing.
Told her that, just like a boy?
That's right. And because I guess she was fidgety. And Fern says, I knew at that point that being a girl was superior.
More power to you, sister. All right, Vijay, she says that when she was 10, the teacher asked for her ambition. She said she wanted to be an archaeologist. And the teacher laughed at her and said there's no such course in our country and that she should forget it. And so she did. And then many years later, she said she figured that she could have studied this overseas if only the teacher didn't laugh at her.
The next one is from Mim Jamil on school days, saying that when he was in Standard 1, one of his teachers didn't allow him to go for a toilet break, and he ended up wetting his pants. And all his friends were laughing at him, and it still haunts him till today.
Oh, no.
Okay, that's sad event.
Yeah, I guess, early traumas do stay with you. Hopefully you get over them. Maybe a bit of therapy might help. And I say that seriously because I think therapy is great as a way of dealing with your emotional, psychological
issues.
Yeah,
and referring to The Cure, I think boys should cry. Actually, real men cry. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, coming back to that story from Bangladesh, especially in a time when we're talking about lowering the voting age and whether young people have the wherewithal to articulate their demands and, articulate their aspirations. High school kids in Bangladesh came out in protest against the death of two young people because of somebody driving a bus very badly. Now, they wanted the government to take this issue of their safety seriously. But what the minister did was to dismiss them. In fact, he accused the kids of being hypocritical. And that just inflamed passions to the extent that they brought Dhaka to a virtual standstill.
I think this is a highly insensitive move by the politician. I mean, this is a serious event, and we're looking at the death of some children by virtue of recklessness. So there needs to be further attention being paid to road safety for the children.
Why don't you think that their demands were taken seriously? Was it just that by virtue of them being young teenagers, you reckon that, you know, people in power perhaps don't pay attention to the demands of the young ones?
I think that's partly it. I mean, I think in patriarchal societies, or very authoritarian societies, or societies in which elders are respected beyond, you know, and for the fact of being older,
okay,
you know, and so young people are just... you know, the famous expression, seen but not heard. Mm. This was the kind of thing that would be said. And it's an English expression. So, you know, dismissing children out of hand. Because if kids become voters, I mean, if you at age 18 can be a voter, maybe then the politicians will take you much more seriously.
Yeah, so, you know, if you take a look at this, the age of these teenagers, they're mid-teens. So probably, you know, 14, 15, 16 or so. Think about how much, I guess, how vocal the teenagers in the US were to fight gun violence in schools. Do you remember how that became a movement and there were spokespeople from, you know, teenage spokespeople fighting gun violence, speaking at large congresses? And I thought that was really amazing. And I'd love to see more of that outside of the US.
Actually, it's strange to think that because a person is young, if they have an opinion, the opinion is worth less. I don't think that's the way to balance it. What is the topic at the end of the day? What is the subject matter that they are talking about that they're so strongly against or for that should really be considered? If it's not just shooting their mouth or talking off their cuff.
Yeah, you know, I the US really didn't start this in any
serious. Yeah,
I mean,
you're right.
You look, there's a grand tradition. South African young people also took
teenagers
to the streets.
As well.
Yeah, you know, and they've done it throughout history, right? You think of the Chinese middle school riots, you know, so-called riots in Singapore, for instance. Again, young people, very political. I mean, some people say they were manipulated, but that's a different issue. But the point is, young people have been involved in politics for a long time. The question is whether they get the recognition. And I think the recognition is, in terms of voting power, I think it's the ultimate recognition for young people.
Yeah, well, you know, the umbrella movement in Hong Kong. Remember that umbrella protest in Hong Kong? That's also really galvanized by the youth. But, you know, this is, I guess, all coming into the fore because as we're looking at lowering the voting age, we do have to recognize, you know, the younger generation is becoming more politically aware, more politically active, and if I may even say, not just politically active, but also, I mean, there's activism is part of their lives now. You know, they champion causes, they feel strongly about issues. It's very different times, and I do think it's well past the time we lower the voting age.
Completely agree with you there, Melissa. I think one of the key drivers of this awareness or this sudden improvement in their knowledge of what's going on is largely driven by the social media, and because they spend so much time, we're looking at about 3.5 to 4 hours a day spent on these devices, gives them the advantage of learning what's going on, because we don't spend our time talking to our children or whatever it may be on political scenarios at home as a casual thing.
If I had children, I'd be talking to them about politics every single moment of the day. Eat your conflicts.
Oh, wow.
Eat your conflicts. It's political. You remember, you can always join this conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio, WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. We'll be back. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, the police with bombs away. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Melissa Idris, and guest hosting with us this morning, Giri Balakrishnan. Now, we turn our attentions to not bombs, but planes. And the decision by the Minister of Defence, Mohammad Sabu, to reveal that only 4 of the 28 Malaysian-owned Russian fighters can take to the air. Just 4 out of 28.
So you're telling me 24 Malaysian fighter jets are grounded, cannot fly?
Yeah, they cannot fly. They're under repair. The question is, of course, first of all, and you've expressed it perfectly, Melissa, just disbelief. I mean, surprise, shock, disbelief.
Jaw on the floor. Jaw,
right. So the issue of the lack of airworthiness or the lack of preparedness in the event of an emergency, a national security emergency, is what I guess we're all thinking about. But there are critics that have come out to say that the defense minister should not have revealed this to the general public.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a little bit, we're questioning really whether we should be making public our defense forces and what we have and what we don't have. So it's a sign of the nation's weakness because we don't have 24 of the six.
24
of the 28 fighter jets. But are we pinning all our hopes on only just 24 jets? I'm sure we have other jets as well, which are quite capable of flying and protecting our skies.
Well, not just that, but also, I mean, you know, what is the sensitivity of this information, right? So let's just say the Defence Minister, Mat Sabu, with this comment from the Defence Minister, is it that other countries are going to be, oh, Malaysia's skies are unprotected, we must attack right now? That is not going to be the case, right? This is, it's a remarkable time of peace. We are not under any immediate threat. I do think that perhaps the intention here was to expose a little bit of mismanagement, right? So the fact that we only have 4 out of 28, clearly that's not good practice. Surely that we must have more than 24 planes on the ground.
Well, you know, Brigadier General retired Mohammad Arshad Raji, who's the president of the National Patriots Association, says that while he understood the government's desire for transparency in matters of security and defense, information should be limited to MPs rather than to the general public. Now, so that's a bit of a nuance in the argument, right? Say, well, okay, you have a responsibility. Parliament ought to know, and both sides of the divide should be clued into the state of affairs, but this should not be shared with the public.
So it's not the right forum, the right platform to share.
Well, that's what the Patriots Association is saying. But I'm not quite sure at this point in time whether, you know, we are reassured by knowing that, that everything's okay. I mean, if you give the appearance that everything is fine, but you're actually, unprepared, what should you do? I mean, should the government at this point say, okay, let's clear the decks and understand what's happening?
I think it's, again, a question of understanding what new Malaysia is all about and how transparent we should really be about a number of things. When it comes to things like national defense, maybe we need to pull back the line a little bit in relation to other matters.
Yeah, so this is the problem. Well, this is the issue with defense spending, defense expenditure, defense purchase, defense contracts and procurement, right? It's so opaque. Because it's national security, you can't tell people what you're buying, how much you're buying for, what specifications. But that is also one of the things that causes it to be one of the, you know, most corrupt or most vulnerable or open to abuse and leakages. So how do you balance the need to protect privacy and national secrecy versus the transparency of being accountable?
You know, there's a tweet here from Jaffa, Red to Debone. SB Jaffa, as his handle, says, I voted for this government so I can criticize them. And I think that's an excellent sentiment, you know, to express it. And it's been expressed by, you know, luminaries like Edward Said, who was on the Palestinian National Council. He says he wants a independent Palestinian state so that he wants to be the first critic of it. So he wants he wants both. And I think many of us share that. I think there are segments of our society who appreciate the fact that we're getting a full picture today. Mm-hmm. Yes, moving forward, when we can be confident that the government is actually doing his job and not trying to enrich itself, that, maybe there'll be areas for some sort of, discretion when it comes to sharing information. But before that, we need to know what's happening on the ground.
Yeah, being critical of things that have already taken place, where we have options to improve and get our footing right. Yes, it makes sense to be able to come out and say what needs to be said, but we still need to be able to understand what kind of information should be shared with the public and what information should be contained within the doors of the government itself.
Okay, tell us what you think. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. WhatsApp us is 018-789-8899. Now, taking us to this next bulletin of the morning, we have The National with The System Only Dreams in Total Darkness. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.